session of our program is entitled New Vistas in Medical Education. We are very fortunate to have with us this morning to head a panel, Dr. Charles Whitfield of the University of Maryland. Dr. Whitfield is Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Maryland. He's also Director of the Alcohol and Drug Education Program. Is one of the guiding lights of a group called IMRSA, which is an organization of career teachers in the field of chemical dependency. Dr. Whitfield is not only a teacher, has done considerable research field work in the field, is a pioneer in the field of non-drug detox, has done some outstanding work in that area. Dr. Whitfield will be presenting his education program for the medical students at the University of Maryland.
Considered the man in the upstairs room number 777. There will now be an Al-Anon meeting for those who wish to participate. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for that introduction, Bill. One of the things that's happening in the field of medical education is that now in about a third of the medical schools across the country, of the roughly 120 schools, there's now a curriculum, some kind of a curriculum, on alcoholism and chemical dependency as a primary illness, as opposed to the education which all the physicians in this audience know that they got, which is about alcohol poisoning or alcohol toxicity. And we became very well educated in how to treat pancreatitis and GI bleeding and many of these medical consequences, but we never got taught about how to deal with the primary illness. And I want to caution, as you read about or hear about programs, new programs in medical schools that are teaching all about alcoholism, that find out how much of the curriculum is devoted to alcoholism as a disease or as a primary problem and how to treat that. And most of the time, it's quite small. For example, we have at the University of Maryland well over 100 hours, probably going up in the 200s or 300s, if we could put all the time together spent not only on the pharmacology courses but on rounds on alcoholic patients, attending rounds, teaching rounds, on alcohol toxicity. Yet we have right now only 13 hours on alcoholism as a primary illness, and a third of our university hospital there is filled with alcoholics. And our clinics are filled with alcoholics and their family members. But I think we're making progress. And part of this progress here is shown on this first slide. The people in the front can see it. I don't know how well you can see it in the back, but I'll try to explain as best I can. This is our an outline of what we have right now at Maryland. Year 1, 2, 3, and 4. We have in the freshman year usually from 1 to 3 hours of curriculum time. This varies because I was told early when I got to Maryland, don't go through the curriculum committee. If you want to stay out of trouble, go make contacts with individual instructors and teachers, and they'll get you on, and that way you can infiltrate the curriculum much more effectively, maybe. And so that's what I've been doing. And so this varies from year to year based on their whims and the students' evaluations as well. But first year we've got from 1 to 3 hours, and we cover definitions, genesis of the problem, and family involvement. So the first year is an introduction. The second year, there's a course that's pretty well set, or a lecture that's pretty well set, on the history and physical examination and this is in the Department of Medicine, and my chairman of medicine asks me to do this regularly every year, and I spend about 15 minutes on history and physical examination, and the rest of the time on alcoholism as a primary illness, including history there as well. But it's not the history that they teach in the regular Department of Medicine teaching about drinking and drug use. And then an introduction to treatment. And that's our first 2 year course. In our third year, we have a 7.5 hour block, which is of 6 seminars that I'm going to show you break down in a minute. And then we have a family medicine rotation that we've just gotten a grant to introduce and have hired a superb teacher to come in and do that. This is going to add 12 hours to our curriculum now, if it goes, so that we'll have about 25 hours in primary alcoholism. And this will be a family medicine rotation that our aim is for it to be required for every medical student who goes through Maryland has to have a 1 month family medicine rotation in their senior year. And about a fourth or a fifth of that 1 month time is going to be spent on alcoholism. Now, the breakdown of this 7.5 hour rotation is as follows. This is on the psychiatry rotation. It just happens that psychiatry is one of our better departments at Maryland, and have given me, an internist, 7.5 hours of their time, and have been very cooperative and supportive, in spite of the fact that most of the members of the Department of Psychiatry don't know what alcoholism is and don't know how to treat it. They still realize that it's important. The first class, I'll just run through the class schedule quickly. The first one is definitions, early recognition, and diagnosis. We call it early recognition and diagnosis when it's just recognition and diagnosis, but we want to get that word early in as much as possible. I've gotten off the public airways onto videotape that I use for teaching several vignettes of celebrities talking about their drinking. And so who I have right now, and if there are any, I guess there would not be any press in this room, would there? Okay. I have Johnny Carson, Ralph Waite, who is the father on the Waltons, Truman Capote, Richard Burton, Betty Ford, Grace Slick, a rock singer, and Elton John, a rock singer, all talking about their drinking and drug use. And these are little vignettes lasting from 30 seconds to 4 minutes, and I showed, these are all edited, because some of them were, like Carson was on 60 Minutes, and the interview was long, so I had to edit it down. But he's talking about his drinking, and it's clear that Carson is a recovering alcoholic from that interview. Yet many of the students, when they first see it, don't get that. And so we go through a little exercise on what the clinical evidence is for Johnny Carson being an alcoholic, and why a physician might miss that if he were to come into the office for a checkup or a follow-up. And so that's part of this first one. We ask them what the clinical evidence is, whether they think they're alcoholic, a heavy drinker, a normal drinker, or they're not sure. And then what the treatment would be for this person and what the prognosis might be. Then we spend the next session on group treatment, and this is AA and group therapy. We bring in an AA member from the community, and he or she tells the story, and then we have a discussion, and we compare and contrast group therapy and AA, and our conclusion is that these two treatment modalities are quite complementary to each other and have many, many similarities. We have occasionally brought in, as the AA member, a recovering physician, and I want to encourage any of you who feel compelled to do this in your medical school community to consider telling your story to some students, because I think it's much more of an impact, at least that's my impression, when the students see this recovering alkie comes in and they don't know it's a physician, and he says, "My name's Joe Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a physician." They're eyes open up and their jaws drop down and they really listen. And then we have a discussion of that. So that's our second session. Then next we have family and Al-Anon. We show them the film, The Enablers, and then we discuss what enabling behavior is, or co-alcoholic behavior, and then how physicians can enable and be co-alcoholics. We bring in an Al-Anon member, again like we did AA, and that person tells their story, and then we have a discussion. Then the next one is on the next two are on other chemical dependencies, and we have some more patient vignettes about that. Most of these are written, and so we hand it out and have the students go over that and say, what would you do now if you were presented with this? And one of those six vignettes is a resident on medicine who is behaving peculiarly, and the student notices that he's using amphetamines and has alcohol on his breath late one afternoon when he's on duty. And what would you do with that? So this is kind of an introduction to what would you do if you had a colleague that you were concerned about. Then the last session is motivating the patient into treatment, and we show the film, the companion film to The Enablers called The Intervention. How many have seen The Enablers and The Intervention? Let me see a show of hands. Okay, maybe a sixth or less of the group. I'd recommend to you that have not seen it, if you can trace down a copy in your community, that these two films are excellent. They are among the two of the best films on alcoholism that I know of today. There are several other very good ones that have come out recently, but these two are outstanding. And it shows how this group intervention using the so-called Johnson technique can be used and how effective it can be. And then we talk about how that can be used by a physician, either some of the techniques in the intervention, one-to-one in the office, or how the physician might help organize such an intervention. And so that's our rotation on psychiatry. The students are required to read a textbook, which some colleagues of mine and I have written, and I've got a copy here. Anybody who wants to take a look at that, they're assigned a lot of readings in this textbook, two chapters for each of these sessions. So they end up with a lot of material, and then they have an examination on it. And I want to show you. These are four or five questions on AA. And every examination, they have 20 questions about alcoholism and drugs, and there are usually two out of those 20 are on Alcoholics Anonymous. So let me just read you these questions to give you a flavor of what these are about. And a lot of AA members and a lot of experts in the field have gone over these questions. Which of the following statements about AA is true? A, its preamble consists of 12 steps. B, presently it reports about 3 million members. C, it focuses on the recovery of upper-class alcoholics. D, its only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And E, it is a religious organization that requires members to believe in a higher power. Next question. All of the following concepts are included in the first step of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, except surrender, concession, powerlessness, unmanageability, and a higher power. The next one. The 12 steps of AA involve all of the following except surrender to a higher power, admission of a drinking problem, personality analysis and catharsis, reliance on someone or something else for help, and an attempt to minimize alcohol use by non-alcoholics. The last one of this sample, I think, is which of the following would probably be the least successful method of getting an alcoholic patient to join a self-help group such as Alcoholics Anonymous? A, asking the patient's spouse to trick the patient into going to a meeting. B, writing on a prescription blank, attend group meetings three times a week and signing your name. C, telling the patient forcefully, I want you to go to several AA meetings. D, educating the patient about group meetings and giving the patient a directory of meetings in the area. And E, calling an active member of the group while the patient is in the office and asking that member to take the patient to a meeting. The medical students have around Maryland do a lot of surprising things for a group of 180 students per class and who are not required to attend class. It's very interesting. They have put out this guide, which they have named the Zebra Guide, a clinical survival manual for students at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. Now, it's interesting that for the most part, almost every page of this guide is on academic survival. It is not on personal survival, although the two sometimes are hard to separate. But the students came to me when they started writing this about 2 years ago, and it's just come out 3 or 4 months ago. It took a long time for them to put it together, but they came to me asking for some guidelines on what to do with their alcoholic patients, because they knew there was a problem for disposition. What do you do? How do you get them in treatment? They were starting to recognize that treatment might be worth considering. And so this is the page that, this is the first part of that page. It's about 2.5 pages in that guide that tells students what to do with their alcoholic patients. It says, when you start on your clinical rotations, you'll soon find that many of your patients are alcoholic. In fact, alcoholism is the third most common disease requiring hospitalization in the United States. Interacting with these patients may at times be difficult. To get the most from these interactions, Charlie Whitfield suggests the following, and so on, going down the line. It's an informal yet very cookbook and a helpful way of approaching. The other thing that the students have done at Maryland is every now and then there'll be a student who recognizes that the curriculum is not maybe as good as it could be, and so we have a student newspaper there, and here's the front of our April-May issue. It says, Shock Trauma Medicine, the Way of the Future. And there's nothing much mentioned in this whole article on the fact that 70% of the people who get to our shock trauma units are alcoholics, and that the shock trauma unit is a terminal alcoholism treatment unit before they either go off to the graveyard or may be rehabilitated. And an interesting thing that's come out of shock trauma is that there are now a lot of paraplegic and quadriplegic alcoholics. And an interesting thing for you to think about is, how does a quadriplegic alcoholic continue his or her habit? And there's always a helper there. And these are very difficult people to rehabilitate, and some of our people are just starting to look into that. But in the back of this paper is an article here that says, Current Curriculum Underemphasizes Alcoholism. That's not my title. That's what the student who got this piece that I wrote and edited it, that's what he titled it, and I think it's appropriate. We have a few hours in training our residents, but not much. Family medicine, we had 6 afternoons. Psychiatry, we had 4 1.5-hour seminars. And primary care, internal medicine, we had 3 1-hour seminars. Our residents are not as good, as well-trained as our medical students. I want to just show you 2 last pictures from an attitude study that I've done. Now, this is a 4-year prospective study. The students were surveyed with about 18 attitude questions about how they feel about alcoholics, and how they feel about treatment, and how they feel about their various roles in treatment. And you can turn that off. Thank you. They were surveyed in their freshman year and then surveyed at the end of their senior year. And we have about 120 students responding, which is well more than half of the class in each of these surveys. And I want to show you 2 of the chart results here. That's about as clear as I can make it. Let me explain this to you. The question says, I feel optimism about the role of physicians in general as a link in recovery. And the dotted line is the freshman answers plotted out, and the solid line is the seniors. And the numbers on the bottom, which are blurred go from 1 to 7 from left to right. 1 to 7. And 7 is strongly agree, and 1 is strongly disagree, and 4 in the middle is neutral. And as you can see, the vertical is number of students. And as you can see here, there's a shift to the right, shift toward the agree, toward positivity, that that they feel optimistic about the role of physicians in general as a link in recovery. Now, this should be taken in context that there was a study in 1975 by Keeley and others that showed that students and residents, as they go through their training, become more negative, not more positive. And so we thought that if we could even get no change, we would be making an effect based on that. One of the most impressive slides or charts, and the last one before I finish here, is on their optimism about the role of AA as a recovery aid. So I think you can see the dotted line, the freshmen, the solid line, the seniors, that they are appear to be impressed with the role of AA as a recovery aid. So that's the end of my talk, and we'll be having some discussion after all of the speakers give their presentations. Well, the next speaker is Bob Fleury from Dartmouth, and I'd like Bob to introduce himself further. Bob?
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I represent Operation CORK, which at the Dartmouth Medical School is called Project CORK. Dartmouth is one of the consortium schools that is involved with developing medical curriculum in the area of, especially in the area for medical students and physicians around chemical dependencies and specifically alcoholism. It was interesting to hear Dr. Cruz talk about Dr. Bob and his rocky road in terms of dealing with stigmas. I don't know how many of you are aware that Dr. Bob went to Dartmouth Medical School in the 1930s, and in fact, Mr. Bill Wilson grew up in and was in Dorset, Vermont when they got together up in Vermont, and I assure you that the road is still rocky, both metaphorically and concretely, in New England with regard to alcoholism. As I said, the task of Project CORK at Dartmouth is to develop a curriculum material dealing with medical issues around alcoholism. I think that the main thing that they have done over the last 3 years at Dartmouth and this 3 years and the initial 3 years of the project ended actually this summer was in terms of defining a scientific body of knowledge in the field of alcoholism relative to medical education. This body of material will become available and has become available in various forms, from films to slide packages to just general pamphlets and things, and will be produced and I think become available to anybody interested in the medical education area. One of the things that's happened is that a resource center at Dartmouth has been continued funding through Operation CORK and is available really to anybody who would like access to a whole body of literature. The resource center, I think, has made an attempt and has developed a rather unique curriculum-oriented database, which anybody can access through writing or calling the Project CORK Resource Center, Dartmouth Medical School, Hanover, New Hampshire. And I really don't have time to go into any much specifically about the content, but it's expansive, and I recommend that those interested contact Dartmouth or else Operation CORK, which is based in San Diego, California. As far as an applied experience dealing with alcoholism, it has been limited in Project CORK to this point. We've had a few limited specific experiences in dealing with students. As I said, most of the experience to date has been in terms of developing the scientific base. The applied experience, I think, is going to follow as the consortium of schools begin to apply the body of data and techniques that we've developed through the consortium, and the project has been funded for 3 more years. So in terms of applied knowledge and looking at the impact that this curriculum will have on medical students and physicians, we hope that we'll see this evolve over the next 3 years. What I'd like to do this morning in my allotted time is look at 2 things. One, the first thing I'd like to share with you is some results from what's called a global survey that Project CORE devised, which is basically a knowledge survey of medical students and has been applied to the consortium schools of Operation CORE. And what I did was I got a sneak look at one question in particular on the survey that had to do with the presence of chemical dependency in people or close to a medical student. And the question on the questionnaire, which I collated in terms of results, was, have you, any member of your family or relative or close friend, had an alcohol or chemical dependency problem? And the sample was 96 medical students from the consortium schools. And let me put the results up. The question, have you, any member of your family, other relative or close friend, had an alcohol or chemically dependent problem? And percentage of positive responses, the students thought that they could identify 19% of parents with chemical dependency problems, 8% siblings were identified as having chemically dependent problems, other relatives 50%, spouse, lover 9%, close friend 34%, medical student associate 26%, and 1% of the medical students identified themselves. I was wondering if that 26% were all thinking about the same person. The interesting result to me, of course, is the composite relative category, parents, siblings, and other relatives, 78% were identified as having alcohol or chemical dependency problems. I think that's quite impressive and worthy of analysis. Again, this is all just a first look at this kind of data. I begged and pleaded and had to almost crawl on my knees to get this to share with you. The second question that I thought was interesting was, do you, the medical student, sometimes drink more than you think you should? And pardon the grammatical error there, but the sample there is 96 medical students, and 49% of them admitted to drinking more than they should at times. I don't know what that means. I think it's interesting, though. It may be a phenomenon of the age group, but again, sort of a teaser and something that I think that Project CORE and the consortium schools will be interested in looking at more thoroughly. Thank you. The last thing that I'd like to do is make some comments relative to medical student self-awareness with regard to chemical dependency. That was my assigned task this morning. And again, as I mentioned, we have a limited experience with regard to working with medical students. But what has evolved has been some thought and some experience. And what we've concluded is that the task seems to be similar to the general task of medical education in getting students to recognize their own potential for illness. There seem to be, throughout traditional medical education, precedents which have gotten away from looking at patients as whole people in terms of a holistic model. Dr. Bergen at Dartmouth has talked about what he describes as, in effect, what occurred through the traditional model of medical education was a segregation of the sick person from the concept of sickness, sort of sickness without the sick man, if you will. And disease became abstracted from the complexities of how it affects the patient's life activities, and reduced to complexities of deviations from the physiologic norms of life activities. This suggests that the process of curriculum development in the alcohol field is not one of dealing merely with the prejudices and phobias of medical students, but rather of dealing with a medical tradition which was built on the irrelevancy of the sick person. Now, experiences at CORE, which we feel supports this thesis. One was a Cork, what we call the Cork intern program, where we took medical students the summer before they actually started their medical training. These are pre-basic science experiences for medical students. And some of the impressions from that experience were that it was easier to correct the prejudices about alcoholics than to convince medical students that working with alcoholics had a relevance to the work of doctoring. I think that's fascinating in and of itself. And the fact evolved as a result of this, of the global survey that I shared one question from, was that students perceive themselves as knowing something significant about alcoholism before beginning medical school. And indeed, this was true as reflected from the knowledge aspects of the global survey. Another area that Dartmouth has had some experience in dealing with medical students' self-awareness with regard to chemical dependency is in terms of a family training experience for medical students, which is both an ambulatory rural experience and as part of that they do simulated patient interviewing with a recovering alcoholic and someone in the department, either clinical staff or professorial status, who's interested in alcoholism. And some of the impressions that evolved out of this experience were that, number one, the faculty perceived a major gain in terms of understanding what the experience of being ill feels like through the simulated patient interviewing experience, and that experiencing the alcoholic's work, the alcoholic's world, as a methodology to introduce a holistic exposure to the sick person was indeed valuable. That the identification and sharing of the human experience as a modality to extrapolate common ground which we all share with our patients occurred through this experience, thus a forum to ponder our own personhood vis-a-vis health and illness was certainly possible through this model. One experience which I had and have had on an ongoing basis is working with the internal medicine students and residents, medical students and residents, in terms of formal didactics. It's something that I perceived happening was that the medical students in particular saw, were amazed to see someone fascinated and interested in alcoholism and working with alcoholism, and seeing that as a model seemed to have some validity in terms of exposing medical students to this material. Therefore, the tasks, which I think we can identify in developing alcoholism models, is it actually a task which is funded for the next 3 years at Dartmouth and the consortium schools, and that is in terms of developing alcoholism as a model for chronic disease. And I think that that's going to have great relevancy not only in terms of developing specific alcohol-related material, but also in terms of the whole issue of chronic disease. And the tasks here seem to be, one, making the concern for the alcoholic relevant to the scientific management of the alcoholic's disease, and to provide an educational experience not based on changing medical students' irrational prejudices, but rather aimed at teaching holistic logic for working with patients. Thus, the task becomes one of infusing the traditional scientific medical model with an integration of the sick person into sickness. And finally, that alcoholism as a possible model for understanding a person's interface with one's environment can evolve, be it one's patient's environment or oneself. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Our next speaker is Jeff Hostetler from Ohio State University, and he'll further introduce himself. Jeff?
There's a story of a man who spilled coffee all over his coat. There's a story of a man who was flying a balloon over Michigan, in fact, over Lake Michigan, and as he passed over the lake, he landed in a field in Wisconsin. The field happened to be owned by one of these doctors who happens to have 22 acres to play with, and the doctor was out in the field. The man in the balloon got out of the balloon, the little basket, and he said to the physician, he says, "Can you tell me where I am?" And the physician said, "Yes, you're in a wheat field in a basket." And the man said, And the man in the basket said, "You must be a physician." And the physician said, "Why?" He says, "Because you've told me the truth, but it's completely irrelevant." And I think when alcoholics come to our offices, we tell them the truth. You have pancreatitis. But that may not be the relevant point. In the spring of 1953, I was 14 years old, not that you care. I saw a man outside my window crawling up the muddy bank that had just been seeded, a new lawn. His name was Skip, and he kept calling out. It was 4 a.m. He said, "Pokey, come get me. Where am I?" My first experience with an alcoholic. I felt pity. I felt pity. Not compassion, pity. Some months later that summer, I was in a house where we had a meeting of several families. A car came into the cornfield, came to a screeching halt, and there in the cornfield, a man got out of his car. He had a gun. He was staggering, and he came toward the house. The man, being macho, moved all the women and children to the back room. My brother and I sneaked down to the car, looked in the back seat, and there was a dead man with 20 bullet holes in him. That is fear, my friends. Pity and fear. Uncle Fred used to come to reunions. He was a successful businessman. He had nice clothes, lots of money, gave 50-cent pieces to us as kids, and we loved him. Fred was an alcoholic, but we didn't know it at the time. When I worked in Evansville, Illinois, for a short period of time, there I saw a woman who had come in from the garbage where she was sleeping, completely filthy, with maggots under her fingernails, under her breasts, and I was repulsed. I wanted to move away. I wanted to almost to vomit. There was a man that lived in our home by the name of Bill Anderson, who would, in the morning, get his clean set of clothes to go help us work, come home in the evening having sold his clothes, almost dead drunk, and he made me angry because we had 7 children. And here this man was taking these clothes and selling them. Pity, fear, hero worship, repulsion, and now anger. And finally, growing up as a child, I used to hear on the radio things like this. "I don't drink, smoke, swear, or chew, or go out with women who do. Strong drink is raging, my friend. Demon rum is the culprit." And with that was the moral indignation that most of us carried as young people. The alcoholic was bad. Not only was the booze bad, but if you drank it, you were up there with murderers and thieves and all those bad people. My friends, coming to medical school are people who have all of these feelings and all of these attitudes mixed in with where they're coming from. And our first task at The Ohio State University is to get in touch with attitudes about alcoholics. Where are you coming from? What do you know about them? And these medical students, I think, need to be taught how to look with compassion, how to look with kindness, how to look with caring, even tough caring. According to Dr. Cruz this morning, our medical students, I'm analyzing what he said, they don't even know what kind of cars are going down this road. Many of them don't even know where the road is. And that's our job at Ohio State University, to begin to work on their attitudes and to begin to teach them how to work with alcoholism, to diagnose and to treat. These emotions that I told you, the fear, the pity, the macho, the repulsion, the anger, the moral indignation, were all tied up inside of me. So when I see an alcoholic, depending on what he or she looked like, it triggered something. Anger, moral indignation. And then I discover what most of you have known for years and years, that alcoholism is a disease. What a relief. That it can be treated, that people do get better, and there is hope, and there is reason to treat, to offer healing, because there is hope. So at Ohio State, we have instituted several programs I think you may be interested in. My role at Ohio State is one of what they call a career teacher. That's where NIAAA has really funded something that I think is exciting. You were talking this morning about what does NIAAA do. They do some great things with their money. The career teacher program goes into the medical school system, and I've spent the last 3 years trying to get into the curriculum materials that matter in drug and alcohol abuse. Materials that count. Not just education, but experience. So I'd like to briefly review those for you to give you an idea of what we're doing. We have several courses now in the curriculum. In the first year, we have a course called An Overview of Substance Abuse, Chemical Dependency. It is a 5-week required course. It has 2.5 hours per week. And each of those 5 weeks, we bring in or talk about special topics. We start out with a recovery panel right up front. 3 physicians, 2 attorneys, and a social worker. They sit up in front. We introduce the disease concept of alcoholism. And then we have these professional people talk about their illness. Briefly, if that can be done. We talk about the history, the denial, the myths, the attitudes, AA. That's the first week. The second week, we deal with diagnosis and drug use taking history. Last year, Charlie Whitfield came to our course and spoke to us and showed his material. It's interesting that where this course lies, even though it's required, some of the students, you know, don't come to these courses. The first day I offered an 80-page handout. That got them there. 230-some students. The second day Charlie was there, we had standing room only. So the topic is appropriate. It's exciting. In the third week, we did women's issues because I'm a believer that it's time we take a look at some of the issues other than all male-oriented. It was an exciting week. That one was. A lot of issues were raised. And some of the men medical students had difficulties with that particular session. In the fourth week, we do treatment. We bring in, of course, patients or clients, and we have the local heads of treatment centers come and talk to the students, and the students can have feedback and talk with them. And then E, since this is a survey course, we talk about some of the other drugs. It's interesting how med students want to get you away from alcohol. They want to hear about the bizarre drugs. They want to hear about my experiences at Haight-Ashbury or somewhere in Kentucky or somewhere down in Texas. They want to hear the bizarre stories. And that's one of the problems you have to deal with. Alcohol, their number one problem, alcoholism, the disease. So we do a little bit with other drugs to take care of that particular session. In addition to that, there are movies and videotapes, and each student must attend an AA meeting. With that attendance, they have to report back on a one sheet how they felt about that. Not analyzing, do you think it works? Not how did you feel? And their number one fear is, how are they going to know I'm not one of them? So what they do, they wear white jackets sometimes, you know. And, it's amazing what they'll go through. So this course, then, is a required course, and it's filled to the brim. The second course, is called a mini module. It is not required. It's in phase one of year one. This is an advanced course. It's also 5 weeks of 2.5 to 3 hours per week. We talk about emergency procedures, the alcoholic patient in context of family, because we're very much interested in the family concept of the disease, a week on adolescent problems, some of the pharmacology, and then methadone maintenance problems there in Columbus. Now, those are just the brief titles without going into all the details of what each one represents. To go with this course, we needed an AA meeting in the hospital. So did you ever try to start an AA meeting in a hospital? That's like moving a graveyard. Those people don't want to hear about it. In fact, I wrote to the dean. It wasn't exactly the dean, but his office, in effect, said, we cannot have an AA meeting here because of security. This is 1981, folks. There are people walking around the halls that are visiting that are thieves. So after much head-banging, and we finally got the meeting started. And now it's every week. The students can go. Patients can go. Look on your wards where the patients are. Many of them need to go and want to go, but there's no meeting. So we can send them right down the hall, and our students can go there. Thirdly, and I do not have a slide for this, we have a 15-week course in psychiatry, and all it is 1 hour session every noon. So it doesn't amount to a lot, but it is 15 weeks that we can work with psychiatry residents and discuss alcohol and drug problems on their turf. But probably the most significant thing we're doing at Ohio State is that we have now clinical rotations, 1 month rotations in drugs and alcohol. It's not a required course, but our students can elect to take 1 month and go to an alcoholism or drug treatment center and spend an entire month there. It has become so popular that we have now to select. We average 5 to 8 students per month. That's 60 medical students a year who are getting 1 month immersion in a treatment center. And I think that has a ripple effect. They have to go into therapy, they have to sit and talk, and they have to write papers on it and come back and report. And their lives, believe me, are changed. It's amazing what happens after they go and spend a month in a treatment center. One other thing that we have, I'm an anatomist. I was, up until 4 years ago. My degree is in anatomy, and so I taught anatomy for many years. And I switched over to drugs and alcohol because of my background and interest. But one of the things I did in anatomy was to work with an independent study program where you give objectives and readings, and then you go to the computer and you get feedback. So what we have is an independent study module you may be interested in. You can write to me for information. It has the objectives and all the reading material in one packet to catch physicians who haven't read about it or new students. Give them that packet and then go away and read about it and come back later and talk. It works on attitudes, knowledge, and behavior. That's basically where we are. We have a gap. We have first-year medical students get a big sweep of information and experiences, and then in the third and fourth year, they get clinical experiences. The second year is a little thin at this point, and that's what we're working on right now. We also have medical students who will come and take personal projects. One of my medical students wanted to write a brochure on marijuana for high school juniors, seniors, freshmen. He started writing this brochure, dropped out of school for a year, and came out with a book called Marijuana, Time for a Closer Look. You can get them in the lobby. I'll be out there to sign them. I have records and videotapes with the group. Actually, I do have a couple of these left, very few. I only have about 600 of them left. So they're $5. If you catch me in the hall, I'll be glad to exchange. Also, I just completed writing a national study guide for NCALI. That's National Clearinghouse. It's a study guide on how to teach medical students about drug and alcohol abuse in the medical setting. And that little booklet, about 80 pages or so, will be sent to every medical school in the United States and every school of osteopathic medicine. So there are about 6 or 7 other guides that are in that series, and we're starting to make a dent, I think, in that. I wanted to mention one other thing. Matthew talked about the American Psychiatric Association a little bit. They are now starting a program. 4 of us are putting on a workshop in Washington in next February for psychiatric residents and how to teach drugs and alcohol in the program. So that's where we're at. Now, you've been sitting on your chairs long enough. I have one other thing I wanted to show you. I mean, these meetings are fun, but I often tell my med students that you all, anywhere except in the ads, of course, you can read about it, somebody getting drunk, some kind of accident due to alcohol. You can read about the disease, and you can see accidents on the front page due to drugs and alcohol. This is so corny, I can't believe I'm doing it. Lives are torn. Jobs are wrecked. People are torn. And this paper apparently is torn. They'll never invite me back, but after I didn't get paid anyway. In fact, if you want to make an analogy, oh, the first drop I had today. Someday, Max, I hope I get a cup like yours. Anyhow, what I'm trying to say is that life may really be looking like quite a mess. And things are really torn up. You can go to AA, you can go to Al-Anon, get some friends to help you, and find out your road to recovery is tough. but it can be done. Not all fun and games, we realize that, but sometime into the life, a little sunshine has to sparkle. Thank you.
Dr. Liebelt, is he?
Yeah, there I am.
Okay. The next speaker is Dr. Robert Liebelt from Northeastern Ohio University.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be here, and we were advised to introduce ourselves. I hesitate a little because I happen to be the provost dean of a medical school, and I'm the one who always seems to be blamed for not having this in the curriculum or that in the curriculum. And I think what I will do is maybe address that point. I think many of the issues that we're focusing on with respect to what's happening in medical education, I think you've had some excellent presentations giving you some ideas of what is taking place with each school, sort of doing it a little differently. But I think the sensitivity is there, and then the question is how best to do it. I would like to tell you a little bit about our medical school because it reflects an issue that I think is facing all medical educators as we move into this so-called consumer era in all fields of activity. Our medical school happens to be a regionalized medical school made up of three large state universities, University of Akron, Kent State University, and Youngstown State University, located in the communities of Akron, Kent, and Youngstown. It also is made up of now some 13 what we call community hospitals, which I think in part is a misnomer, in that one's perception of a community hospital varies from region to region and state to state. And also, I think the fact that there are hospitals that have had long traditions in medical education, and that characterizes the hospitals we have in the communities of Akron, Canton, and Youngstown. As we tried to put together a consortium, in effect, we decided that we had to have a biomedical science contingent, and this was a facility built in a little community of Rootstown that no one has ever heard about. It has one stoplight off of Interstate 76. And I mention these things to you because, in effect, the medical school that I represent is located in each of these institutions that I speak of. Secondly, we do not have any so-called full-time College of Medicine clinical faculty. All of our clinical faculty are practicing physicians in these respective communities. And I think this is very important insofar as the so-called role model phenomenon. One may raise some questions, and it's been raised many times by accrediting bodies and sister institutions throughout this state and across the country. How can you run a medical school when only practicing doctors teach the students? And I'll just say this, it works by all criteria that we have today to measure it. And I can say it with more confidence today than I could 2 months ago because we finally graduated our first class of 42 students on May 31st, 1981. And any criteria that you want to use, our students have done very, very well. But more importantly, and this is a clinical judgment, I realize, they are definitely community-oriented towards the practice of medicine in spite of the fact that some would say that we're only training family practitioners, which we do not adhere to that principle. Admittedly, we hope a half of our students will go into primary care, and indeed, I can uncross my fingers, 52% of the first class went into primary care, but the others went into any other specialty you might mention, and that has been consistent with our philosophy that we are going to educate doctors of medicine so that they can take opportunity any place they want to. Now, one of the problems that a new medical school has that many of those in the established medical schools seem to envy us for is to say, oh boy, you can start afresh. You can really do things right. You can teach alcoholism, geriatric medicine, sexuality, nutrition, industrial medicine, and down the list it goes. And indeed, when I first came to this region 8 years ago, I was confronted in all places of the region, including supermarkets and the like, having the so-called little old ladies come up to me and saying, "What is your school going to do about teaching geriatric medicine to your students?" And I said, "Oh, we're going to do a lot." I wasn't sure I knew what it was at the time, but I felt that was a good answer. Then we were confronted by the various alcohol groups in the region, and Ohio has some very strong organized groups. "And what are you going to do about alcoholism teaching?" And then we were approached by the people interested in sexuality and nutrition. And this is a real problem for us so-called deans, because everybody has something they feel is essential, and it's all essential. Recently, I was approached by the group in arthritis, and an Arthritis Anonymous group has been started, of all places, at St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, where your program is started. And I think what it tells me is that there are commonalities here with respect to these issues. In terms of science, we're talking liberally about it being interdisciplinary. But I think it also focuses upon what already has been talked about by many people this morning, behavioral issues and things of that nature. My biggest problem, frankly, is the accreditation process, in that I am obliged by the criteria established by the accrediting bodies of this country, which happens to be the Liaison Committee on Medical Education, and although I respect the process and I'm a subscriber to the process, without, I think, realizing it, we are forced into certain kind of programs. And this creates teaching difficulties for us. And it's a very simple thing. It's a survival problem. If we do not teach adequate anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, internal medicine, what have you, our students do not do well on national boards, they do not do well on state board examinations, and we have failed. And yet we are advised, on the other hand, to innovate, experiment. And so we are confronted with pressures, just like any other group, I guess, in society, of conforming towards certain traditions. And this creates these problems I alluded to. For example, I am curious about programs that I see being taught in the first year of medical school, when the student's time is being competed for by 8 to 10 hours per week in anatomy, or 8 hours per week in biochemistry, and then 1 hour per week on alcoholism or geriatric medicine, what have you. And from a purely survival